To books next, and three very good reads by three very different novelists, an Irish, an English and an Indian American. We're looking at Colm Tobin's The Testament of Mary, Harvest by Jim Crace, and Jhumpa Lahiri's The Lowlands, and all three are on this year's Man Booker long list. And to give us a flavour of all three, I'm joined in studio by Niall McMonagall and by actress Katrina Inewuraku and Barry Barnes, who are going to read excerpts. Niall, these three writers were already well-known, well-established and highly acclaimed.
Yeah, I mean, anyone interested in literary fiction will know these three, and they've all already deservedly won awards. Tobin won the Impact, the Costa Novel Award. He's been shortlisted twice for the Booker. Jim Crace has won the Whitbread, the Guardian Prize, the National Book Circle Award, and his novel Quarantine was shortlisted for the Booker. And Jhumpa Lahiri has won a Pulitzer, a Penn Hemingway, and the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award.
Okay, so there's the credentials, so three big guns. And I presume all three could actually make it easily onto the shortlist. So we could be looking at one of the overall winner here.
Well, perhaps. Maybe. But, you know, predicting, Miles, it's a mug's game. James Joyce never won the Nobel, and judges differ. Novels sometimes die only to bounce back later. I mean, time is really the best judge, and time does the real choosing and winnowing. But give these three novels a go and you won't be disappointed.
Okay, now they're very different in terms of setting. Ephesus, Middle England and Calcutta / Massachusetts.
And not only different in terms of setting, Miles, but they've also been set at very different times. We go back 2,000 years for Tobin. Jim Crace evokes medieval England. And Lahiri covers 60 years from the 1950s right up to the present.
OK, we'll start with Colm Tobin. I suppose you could argue it isn't a novel at all. It began its life as a play, and it's about a world-famous but rather silent figure.
Yes, her story is known, but it hasn't been told. The Virgin Mary is traditionally a passive figure. She's even the butt of a Joan Rivers joke when Rivers says, "Do you mean the real Madonna or the Mother of God?" Well, she's no longer silent. She certainly gets her say here in Tobin's version. This is a "Let's Hear It from Mary" piece, and it turns any preconceptions you might have about a meek and mild Mary upside down. Yes, it was originally a play, a one-hander. Marie Mullen played Mary in October 2011 in The Project, and Fiona Shaw played her earlier this summer on Broadway. But it also works really well on the page. It's a sustained monologue. It runs only to 100 pages. And yes, it is different from what you might expect in a novel. It has almost no conversations. But Tobin does capture brilliantly what every really good novel must have: drama, vividly realised scenes, depth of character.
OK, so what is this other side of Mary as portrayed by Colm Tobin?
Well, here is Mary in the opening pages. She's a prisoner in her own home in Ephesus, and is towards the end of her life, and she is both heartbroken and determined.
"I have forgotten how to smile. I have no further need for smiling, just as I had no further need for tears. There was a time when I thought that I had, in fact, no tears left, that I had used up my store of tears. But I am lucky that foolish thoughts like this never linger, are quickly replaced by what is true. There are always tears if you need them enough. I no longer need tears, and that should be a relief. But I do not seek relief, merely solitude, and some grim satisfaction which comes from the certainty that I will not say anything that is not true."
She's being put under pressure. Is she not to concoct a version of events?
Yes, and she doesn't like it one bit. I mean, Mary is an essential presence, obviously, in the life of Jesus. He couldn't have happened without her. She gives birth to him, and then she's there when he dies. But in Tobin's version, she is headstrong, suspicious, and she deeply loves her son. And she strongly disapproves of the misfits and wasters, as she calls them, that followed Jesus. And she was at the crucifixion, but in this version, she doesn't witness his death.
And why is... Do you think that Tobin is rewriting what has been that gospel, obviously, gospel literally, for the last 2,000 years?
Because the novel looks at something really fascinating. It sees religion as a powerful and interesting cultural construct. How did these accounts by the evangelists come about? Mary is suspicious of her son's friends, who are, she says, too locked into their vast and insatiable needs. Jesus is dead, and now the memory making begins. and Mary doesn't like what they are doing or how they are going about it. Tobin's Mary is a fiercely intelligent woman. She knows and understands better than anyone her dead son and what is happening to him now. And two unnamed men, presumably Mark and John, they visit her and write things down, but they won't write it down as she says it happened.
So she sees what they're about and she resents this.
Oh, yes, you can see this very clearly in the next extract. She is here addressing the two men who come and visit her.
Do not sit in that chair. You can use the one beside it, but not that one.
I cannot use a chair. What else are chairs for? I cannot sit on a chair.
No one sits on that chair.
No one?
No one.
Why not? Why not?
Don't sit there.
But you must explain.
The chair is left for someone who will not return.
But he will return.
No, he will not.
Your son will return.
The chair is for my husband.
Very spare, very powerful writing. And then she produces a knife and threatens him. You don't mess with this, Mary. And you can see that she is here both wife and mother. She misses both of them and she believes that neither is coming back.
Sounds like a very interesting portrait. Is it a convincing portrait?
Not really convincing.
Overall?
I think it's totally credible and very moving without being mawkish. In a very tender passage, Mary, for example, describes the horror of watching her son carry the cross. He tries to remove the crowns of thorns to ease his pain, a really human touch, and she feels absolutely helpless.
He was the boy I had given birth to, and he was more defenceless now than he had been then. And in those days after he was born, when I held him and watched him, my thoughts included the thought that I would have someone to watch over me when I was dying, to look after my body when I had died. In those days, if I had even dreamed that I would see him bloody, and the crowd around filled with zeal that he should be bloodied more, I would have cried out that day, and the cry would have come from a part of me that is the core of me.
Now, as you said, it's a very short book. It's only 100 pages or so. But Colm Tobin focuses on some of the major events, the kind of iconic moments, if you like, the raising of Lazarus, the marriage feast of Cana, and obviously, as we've just heard, the crucifixion.
Yes, and the water to wine miracle, which we all associate with being the first miracle, Tobin reverses it and he puts the raising of Lazarus first. And he gives all of these miracles a real gritty kind of touch. For example, the rescued Lazarus finds little joy when he has been brought back to life. And the crucifixion, well, it says the crucifixion as you've never seen it before. The biblical account is spare and powerful and objective. What Tobin does is remarkable. The death of Christ on the cross is a chaotic affair.
It was like a marketplace, but more intense somehow. As if the act that was about to take place was going to make a profit for both seller and buyer. For the nailing part, we stood back. Each of the nails was longer than my hand. I tried to see his face as he screamed in pain. It was the voice I recognized, the sounds he made that belonged only to him. I stood and looked around.
There were other things going on. Horses been shooed and fed, games been played, insults and jokes been hurled, and fires lit to cook food.
And Mary does not stay for the actual death. She's afraid. She runs away. And the gist of the novel really is that Mary is saying that the price is too high. She's not interested in her son saving the world. And this is powerfully articulated in the closing pages. The evangelists want to write their version. Mary isn't interested. She tells them,
if water can be changed into wine and the dead be brought back, then I want time pushed back. I want to live again before my son's death happened, or before he left home, when he was a baby and his father was alive and there was ease in the world. I was there. I fled before it was over. But if you want witnesses, then I am one. And I can tell you now, when you say that he redeemed the world, I will say that it was not worth it. It was not worth it.
And they're the words really that ring in our ears. At the very end of the novel, she is visiting a temple. She is adoring Artemis, she has reverted to a kind of different religion altogether.
Hmm, interesting. Okay, next to Jim Crace's Harvest, another novel set in the past.
Yeah, this brings us back to the heart of medieval England. Not a date is given, it's not a Hilary Mantel kind of historical novel, but it focuses on the enclosures and what Crace calls the closing and the engrossment of our fields. It's another first-person narrative, this time a farm labourer, Walter Thirsk, and is told in the present tense, which adds real immediacy. Thirsk has lived in this spot in remote rural England for 12 years, but everything changes over the course of 1 week. The novel contains burnings, the brutal killing of a horse, false imprisonment, getting high on mushrooms, distrust, murder, torture, the ending of a way of life, and the writing is powerful and beautiful. Here's Walter Thirsk remembering his first impressions of this place.
When I first came to these vicinities, I thought I'd discovered not quite paradise, but at least a fruitful opportunity. Some honest freedom and some scope.
But during the course of the novel, dramatic changes take place. The freedom and scope are diminished. It's no Forest of Arden, it's no Garden of Eden. There's dishonesty, promiscuity, and there's a wonderful earthy, bawdy flavour to the thing.
The harvest teamwork allowed us to be lewd. Our humour ripens as the barley falls. It's safe to spread the gossip noisily, it's safe to bait and goad. Whose sharing wives, which widower, they look at me, has dipped his thumb in someone else's pot. Which blushing youngsters are the village spares, that's to say, those children who've been conceived in one man's bed and then delivered in another's. Nothing is beyond our bounds when we are cutting corn.
Now, three strangers arrive in the book and build a hut on the outskirts of the village.
Yeah, this is the beginning of the trouble, really. And the man, his son and daughter-in-law have been displaced from their own land, so they settle near this village. And they are attacked by the villagers, falsely accused of setting fire to the master's stables. Their heads are shaved and the men are pilloried. They're put in the stocks.
And another visitor during that same week has very bad news for the villagers.
Yes, it's a busy week, Miles, but this is Edmund Jordan, who, being a blood relation, has a claim to the manor house, and things turn nasty when he and his men announce that 60 people who ploughed the land here all their lives must now make way for 3,000 sheep. Change is coming, and Crace sums it up in one sentence: the sheaf is giving way to sheep. But before all that happens, the harvest has been gathered and it's time for celebration. A land surveyor nicknamed Mr. Quill produces a fiddle and the villagers dance to celebrate the bringing in of the harvest.
Mr. Quill, the fiddler, is shaping us again, making us congruous and geometrical with his melodies, as he has done with his charts and ink. His dance is circular, then it is square. It's 4th and 20, swing and stump, it's reels and sets and thundering. The revellers are being asked to go beyond their normal selves, to be more liquid, actually. The women skirmish with the men, stamping feet and swirling kerchiefs. The mopsies and the lads are far too close, they're holding wrists, they're touching waists. It's possible, in such a ducking light and with such happy havoc in command, that kisses are exchanged and promises. We are a heathen company. We find more pleasure in the song and dance of God than in the piety. Thank heavens that we do not have a priest to witness it.
Okay, so it sounds like raucous, wild merrymaking.
Yeah, but Crace can also write measured lyrical prose. Here's a passage that reflects on the passing of time and the rhythms of the year.
Can it really be almost a year since we last led out our oxen and took our ploughs to it? Fixing our eyes in the leaf-bare treetops in the dell to keep our furrows straight and true, on what I recall to be a dull and chilling day. Then once the cold had nipped the clod, we came again for harrowing, flattening ridges to provide the fine tilt that best comforts barley, picking out the surface stones. Can it really be half a year since spring, when we fixed our eyes again on those same tops to see them fattening with leaf, and we spread out across the field in rows to broadcast seed, throwing our grain forward equally and to the swing of every step, spreading tiny vows with a plentiful hand.
Listen to that repetition, the rhythm, those memorable images that turn prose into poetry. And look at how he uses broadcast there when he says to broadcast seed. He's like Seamus Heaney in that he is so alive and alert to language. He rescues it from jaded use and gives it new life.
I like the idea of comforting the barley as well. It's a beautiful phrase. Why does a novelist like Christ, living in Birmingham in the early 21st century, turn his attention, do you think, to England centuries ago?
Well, you know, Christ has set many of his novels in the past, but he always has his eye on contemporary events. Harvest tells of people's suspicions of the outsider, of small communities interacting, imploding, of powerful people making changes for their own personal gain. And the most resonant sentence in the novel is the one that reads,
"Go back where you belong."
So you can see how it has a real contemporary feel to it as well. But it also contains wise, interesting observations.
Our fields are medicine. All days prove good to those that love the open air.
The frost will finish what the plough begins. Winter will provide the spring.
I understood that the land itself, from sod to meadow, is inflexible and stern. It is impatient. In fact, it cannot wait. There's not a season set aside for pondering and reveries.
Is a real hymn to the land, but more importantly, it has a real social and political dimension as well. It's a really worthwhile book.
Mm-hmm. Finally then, Jhumpa Lahiri's The Lowland.
That's right. This is Lahiri's fourth book, and she is a really, really satisfying read. She's a terrific storyteller, and if you pick this up, you'll want to do nothing else until you finish it.
OK, tell us about her world.
Well, the world is family, and her focus really is born out of her own background. She was born in London, grew up in Rhode Island. She now lives in New York. But her background is Bengali, and so she explores cultural nuances, cultural differences, cultural conflicts within and between families, within countries. And this new novel, The Lowland, is set in both India and America. It's the story of two brothers, Subhash and Udayan, and they are close in age, very alike in looks, but the older Subhash is very shy. Here's how Lahiri establishes the difference between them.
Since childhood, Subhash had been cautious. His mother never had to run after him. He kept her company, watching as she cooked at the coal stove or embroidered saris and blouse pieces commissioned by a lady's tailor in the neighbourhood. He helped his father plant the dahlias that he grew in pots in the courtyard.
And yet Subhash grows up knowing that his parents did not favour him over Udayan. And Subhash is placid, Udayan is a daredevil. In the opening pages, Udayan's personality is captured as follows.
In the courtyard of their family's house was the most enduring legacy of Udayan's transgressions. A trail of footprints created the day the dirt surface was paved. A day they'd been instructed to remain indoors until it had set. All morning they'd watched the mason preparing the concrete in a wheelbarrow, spreading and smoothing the wet mixture with his tools. 24 hours the mason had warned them before leaving.
But of course, Udayan leaves his mark in the wet concrete.
And is this a sign of things to come?
You bet. I mean, as young men, their differences are even more pronounced. Subhash goes to America to study. He becomes a chemical oceanographer. Udayan becomes a political activist. And now here's the problem. This book has that big, old-fashioned, delicious pleasure miles plot. And I don't want to say too much about what happens, but put it this way. There's a killing by military police. There's the emergence of the Naxalite communist movement. There are two marriages. A child grows up not knowing a profound truth about herself. A young woman has a baby and she doesn't want to tell the father of her child. Decades pass. We follow these characters from childhood to adulthood, from Calcutta to Rhode Island to California. There's even a chapter set in the Bera Peninsula. We learn about social unrest and political turmoil. There are anti-Vietnam protests in the US. But with Lahiri, it never reads as a history lesson. It's always a vital part of the characters' lives.
Okay, there's a lot of plot you've just described there. If though family is her focus, is it a happy family? Is it an unhappy family?
Oh, unhappy, like most interesting novels. But you finish this book sadder, wiser. And here's a scene between a mother and son. Subhash has bought a gift for his mother and sister-in-law, but the mother disapproves. Gauri, her daughter-in-law, and her son, was not an arranged marriage, so she cannot really bless it.
I'd like to give her this.
You should know better. Stop trying to befriend her. I heard the two of you talking yesterday.
I'm not supposed to talk to her?
What did she tell you?
Why don't you ever talk to her? You've taken her coloured clothes, the fish and the meat from her plate.
And these are our customs.
It's demeaning. Udayan would never have wanted her to live this way. Does it mean nothing that she's going to give you a grandchild?
It means everything. It's the only thing he's left us.
And what about Gowri?
She has a place here if she chooses.
What do you mean if she chooses?
She could go somewhere to continue her studies. She might prefer it.
What makes you think that?
She's too withdrawn, too aloof to be a mother.
Have you discussed any of this with her?
There's no point in worrying her about it now.
You can't separate them. Udayan's sake, accept her.
Shut your mouth. Don't tell me how to honour my own son.
Right, that's a pretty intense exchange, so things are a bit complicated.
They are indeed, and I mean, there are wonderful scenes in this novel where a mother confronts her daughter towards the end of the book, and later in the novel, Subash utters a chilling statement, and really it's the crux of the novel.
You don't deserve to be a parent. The privilege was wasted on you.
She's really excellent in family tensions, disappointments, Hindu customs. You become very involved, and all the time you're nodding in recognition as you read, because everything is just so alive before you on the page.
The need to tell her hung over him, terrified him. It was the greatest unfinished business of his life.
And a sentence like that just keeps you reading. And her descriptions of place, the beach in Rhode Island or the bustling world of Calcutta are so vivid. You see them, you smell them.
OK, finally, which is the most readable? Which do you think is the one that could win the Booker Prize? Which is not necessarily the same thing as being the most readable.
Well, undoubtedly the most readable and the most enjoyable is the Lahiri. There's no question in my mind about that. It's a book you could give to anyone. But the Thobeen and Crace are really, really impressive. I mean, Crace's novel is a work of art. But if I were choosing a book to give to someone, I would say Jhumpa Lahiri, okay. The Lowland.
We'll call that a tip for the Booker Prize this year. We've been looking at The Testament of Mary by Colm Thobeen, Harvest by Jim Crace, and The Lowland by Jhumpa Lahiri, all three on the Man Booker longlist. The Booker shortlist will be announced on the 10th of September. Barry Barnes, Katrina Niwuraku and Niall McMonagle, thank you all very much.
Thank you.